From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Leanne Hansen. Maya Angelou has lived many lives: poet, performer, political activist, and professor. She's also a mother, great-grandmother, and mentor. And now she is celebrating her 80th birthday. Born in St. Louis on April 4, 1928, her parents named her Marguerite Johnson. She decided to change that name when she started her life as a performer and began her transition to the artist she is today. A new biography of Maya Angelou has been published to coincide with her birthday, and Maya Angelou joins us now from her home in New York to talk about her life. Welcome and happy birthday.
And thank you very much for both.
Now, as I just mentioned, you changed your name to Maya Angelou when you began performing as a calypso singer in the 1950s. But I understand you had some inspiration in that from your own great-grandmother. Can you tell us that story? Your great-grandmother changed her name when she was freed from...
Oh, that's true. My great-grandmother was born a slave and lived as a slave until the end of slavery. And at that time, she changed her name to Kentucky Shannon. And when asked, even into the 20th century, why did she change her name to Kentucky Shannon? She said because she liked the sound of it. And we asked her, everybody asked her, if she had been enslaved in Kentucky. She wouldn't say. She didn't want to have anything to say about slavery. But my brother changed my name early on and changed me from Marguerite to Maya. Uh-huh. He first just called me my sister. And then he called me Maya. He read about the Mayan Indians. And so he named me Maya. And I married someone who had a name like Angelo. And that's it.
And that's how you changed your name?
Yes. It seemed to have been changed for me.
When you did change your name and began being called Maya Angelou, did that in any way sort of symbolize a kind of transition that was going on in your life as you were becoming an artist?
I suppose so. But, you know, an artist becomes and is made and has artistry thrust upon them. Everybody born comes from the Creator trailing wisps of glory. We come from the Creator with creativity. I think that each one of us is born with creativity.
But you first started sort of manifesting that creativity and the artist in you as a dancer and as a singer. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, well, I can sing somewhat. But I used to really be a dancer. And the only two things I ever loved was dancing and writing. But alas, before I was 25, my knees turned out to be not the best. So I had to stop dancing for a living. And I could sing somewhat. I'm not being coy. I have no coyness or modesty. So I was never a good singer because I never loved it. Hmm. Whatever you want to do, if you want to be great at it, you have to love it and be ready to make sacrifices for it. And I wasn't prepared to make sacrifices for singing. Hmm. But I will make sacrifices to write.
Yeah. But that period of your life where you were singing, and I think you were a calypso singer and dancer, and then...
Yes, I was known as Miss Calypso. And when I'd forget the lyric, I'd just tell the audience, I seem to have forgotten the lyric, I will now dance. And I would move around a bit.
How did you make the transition to writing? You said that you always loved writing.
Yes. I started writing when I was, maybe 8 or 9. I've always loved it. But from the time I was 7 and a half or there, until I was 13, I didn't speak. I was what was called a volunteer mute. But I read everything. And since I liked poetry, I thought, well, let me write it. I wrote some of the worst poetry west of probably the Mississippi River, but I wrote. And I finally sometimes got it right.
Of course, you really became famous with your memoir, your autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Yes.
Came out in 1970, gigantic bestseller, nominated for the National Book Award. How did that book change your life?
Well, in a very interesting way, Miss Neary, I had thought when I started to write it that I would write one book and that would be it. I'd be able to include my life and my feelings, my philosophy, my discipline, etc. But it wasn't. I just got to 17. And so I thought, well, maybe I can do one more. And of course, the last book in the autobiographical series is Song Flung Up to Heaven. Six books.
Do you have another autobiography in you?
No, I don't. No, it's the end of it. Okay. I used a poem of Paul Laurence Dunbar for the title of the first book, and a poem of that same poem for the title of the last book. The poem is Sympathy. Mr. Dunbar wrote this in about 1894. And the poem says, I know what the caged bird feels. Ah, me. When the sun is bright on the upland slopes and the river floats like a sheet of glass and the bud on the branch still opes, I know what the caged bird feels. The last verse says, I know why the caged bird beats its wing till its blood is red on the cruel bars. It must fly back to its perch and cling when it fain would be on the bower swing. And a song comes from its deep throat. Upward to heaven, it is a prayer that upward to heaven it flings. So that those are the titles of those two, the bookends, the first and the last of the series.
As successful as your memoirs have been, as you said, poetry has always been your first love. Why is that? What is it about poetry that allows you to express something that you can't express in any other way?
Well, poetry is at once the use of the language and music, and it is music. Young people all over the world, you ask them to repeat some of the popular music of their day. In some cases here, hip-hop, rock and roll. People know those lyrics. Now why? They can't sing the melody quite often, but they remember the lyrics because it is poetry. And the spirituals when I was young, and just imagine a lyric which says, go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. Our deep river, my home is over Jordan. I want to go home to Canaan land. Goodness gracious, if that's not poetry, then Shelley never wrote, and James Weldon Johnson didn't write Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Do you have a favorite poem of your own? Can you
Of my own? No, it would be the last poem I wrote. I don't have any favorites. Some things you use at certain times. You know, if you're lonely or you feel you've been done down, it's nice to have And Still I Rise. You can find a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, early 20th century white female poet. Thin, slim, about to become the recluse she did become. And this little woman wrote, I shall die, but that is all I will do for death. With his horse's hooves on my chest, I will not tell him where the black boy lies hidden in the swamp. I shall die, but that is all I will do for death. Brothers and sisters, the keys and the plans to this city are safe with me. It's nice to hear that.
It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I have to ask you about another part of your life, because there are so many parts of your life. Politics has run all through your life, you've been very involved in politics, really, since the 60s, I think. Mm-hmm. I know that you're a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but I wanted to ask you, even given that, you know, what does it mean to you that in your own lifetime you are seeing this election where both a woman and a black man have a real shot at the White House?
It's so exciting. And you know, I had someone ask me, but things haven't changed, have they? Please. Are you kidding? Things have changed. We have to admit that we've come a long way, so that young people would not be encouraged to say, you mean to say with the lives and deaths of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the Kennedys and Mahatma Gandhi, you mean to tell me things are no better? Well, then what's the point of me trying?
Yeah.
Young people must be told, yes, things are better. Not nearly as good as they will be when you put your shoulder to the wheel.
You know, this book, which celebrates your life, is full of photos that show you surrounded by family and friends, and it's also full of recipes, and you really like to have fun.
Yes, I do. I work very hard, and I play very hard.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for life, and I live it. I believe life loves the liver of it. I live it, and I try to live it as a Christian. Trying to be a Christian means that I'm trying to take responsibility for the time I take up and the space I occupy. I am relieved to have a faith that there's no place that God is not. I have to know that. And my faith usually keeps me all right, but I lose it. And I say with the apostle and with the prophets, Father, I believe, forgive my disbelief.
Maya Angelou, a new biography, Maya Angelou, A Glorious Celebration, has just been published to coincide with her 80th birthday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
American cities were burning 40 years ago following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He had preached nonviolence and racial equality, but his murder provoked both pain and anger on the streets. On April 7, 1968, 3 days after Dr. King was killed, singer and pianist Nina Simone gave a concert at the Westbury Music Fair on Long Island, New York. Active in the civil rights movement, Simone was known for songs like Mississippi Goddamn, which pulled no political punches. The concert was a cathartic event. Simone was at the height of her powers and filled with anguish. "The king is dead," she said into the microphone. "The king of love is dead." That night, Simone and her band performed a new song.
We want to do a tune written for today, for this hour, for Dr. Martin Luther King.
The name of the song was Why. It went on for 13 minutes. Nina Simone sang and played and sermonized and asked the questions no one on that day could answer. The song was written by her bass player, Gene Taylor. Simone's brother, organist Samuel Wayman, was on stage with her that day.
We learned that song that day. We didn't have a chance to really like have 2 or 3 days of a rehearsal. But when you're feeling compassion and outrage and wanting to express what you know the world is feeling, we did it because that's what we felt.
'Cause he'd seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, 'cause we're headed for the brink. What will happen now that he is dead? He was for equality for all people, you and me. Full of love and goodwill, hate was not his way.
Yeah, she didn't know what she wanted to do. She didn't know whether she could do it. Through the tears, the hurt, confusion, what do you do at a moment like that?
Well, the murders never cease. Or do they ever hope, ever hope to gain? Will my country stand or fall? Is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain?
So many questions she had, so many questions that song
yeah,
has.
Yes. You just touched a nerve.
Do you remember what that felt like as you were listening to her?
Yes, just like I'm feeling right this minute. Pretty emotional. The questions in the song are the questions that are still being asked today about hatred, injustice, discrimination, lack of peace around the world that's going on today. The song is timeless.
He had seen mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with a threat, death ahead. Come on, Sam. Folks, you'd better stop and think while we're almost to the brink. What will happen now that the king of love is dead?
Nina Simone, in a tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. She was performing 40 years ago, 3 days after King's assassination. We heard memories of the concert from her brother, organist Samuel Wayman. He was on stage with Nina Simone that day at the Westbury Music Fair on Long Island. Listening to NPR News. So Daniel Zwerdling is still with us in the studio. And Danny, when people come back from Antarctica, you know, they usually talk about icebergs. So they talk about how cold it is. They might talk about penguins. You've just come back there, and you're here to talk this week about food in
yep.
Antarctica?
The cooking of Antarctica. Just think about how much you and how much some people think about what they eat day to day. So imagine now that you're living in the most extreme place on the planet. Meals take on a special power.
You know, I have to admit, I have never thought about the cuisine of Antarctica. So I am interested.
And I hadn't until I went there. So to explain, let's start our food tour just off Antarctica's coast. One afternoon, I joined a scientist named Donald Manahan, and we're actually walking on top of the sea. It's frozen under 6 feet of ice. Manahan's research team is digging a hole through this ice because they're studying how global warming is affecting life underwater. And Lynn, as we're standing there, what do you think this scientist is thinking about? Carbon dioxide emissions?
The future of civilization?
Nope. He's thinking about dinner.
I've never enjoyed food more in my life than I have working in Antarctica.
Lynn, picture the context. There is nothing green on the continent. No trees, no bushes, not a single blade of grass. At the moment, it's 10 degrees below zero with the wind chill. And Manahan says this strange environment can make you feel off balance. So meals are a serious matter.
One of the things that really makes you feel alive is to come out here, do this work in the cold, and then zoom back to the base and have a nice, warm dinner. Yum, yum. One of the things they pay a huge amount of attention to here is the quality of the food. trying to make sure there's a lot of variety, because, you know, it does affect your psychology.
That's why the emotional center of America's main base in Antarctica is the cafeteria.
Hi, whole wheat with Dijon mustard, prime rib, provolone.
The dining hall is in the main building in the middle of the complex. They call it McMurdo Station, and it's, well, it's ugly. The U.S. Navy built most of this base in the 1950s and 60s, and they chose a spectacular setting that looks out at the frozen sea and at an icy mountain range. But then they ruined the view. It's a jumble of corrugated metal buildings and tacky dormitories. They painted everything sickly brown.
Can I get a turkey sandwich on wheat?
About 1,100 people live here during Antarctica's long summer, but only a few hundred are actually scientists. Most of the staff drive bulldozers or fix leaky roofs, or they cook, like Amanda Bell.
I'm trying to remix the chocolate. We made a chocolate glaze of butter, cream, and dark chocolate to put on top of the eclairs. Would you like to try one?
These are the people who keep the place running, so scientists can work in Antarctica at all. The head chef at McMurdo is Sally Ayotte. She's wiry, like a sprinter. In fact, she races through the kitchen past giant deep-fat fryers. Ayotte says the first time she came to Antarctica, it was back in the 1990s. And when she stepped off the plane,
I looked around and was like, oh my God, what have I done? It's easy to see that you're just at the bottom of the world. You're in the middle of nowhere.
Ayotte says she got sort of depressed. Everything's upside down in Antarctica. The sun rises once each year. Then it blazes 24 hours a day for months. Then the sun sets only once a year. And it stays dark for months. And most people are basically trapped here. You can't wander far from the base or you could die. But Ayotte says one day it suddenly hit her. Everybody else in Antarctica was in the same boat.
You work, you sleep, you eat.
And she realized she could make a huge difference in people's lives just by making them happy when they eat. To show how she and her cooks try to do it, Ayotte takes us on a tour.
So please, of course, step this way. Watch your step.
To begin with, it's all you can eat in Antarctica. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. There's often an omelet station and maybe a roast beef station. And there are rows of stainless steel warming trays piled with mountains of food.
We have the chili for lunch today. We have the pub cod with fries.
And there could be spicy shrimp with rice noodles. Grilled mahi-mahi with papaya salsa. If you're a vegetarian, there's mushroom and barley risotto or falafel with tzatziki sauce. Now, this menu might not sound unusual if you were visiting, say, a university in California, but this is the bottom of the world. They get most of their food by ship. The ship makes one delivery per year after the icebreaker clears the way. So most of their ingredients are frozen, canned, or dried. And Ayotte says that's a challenge for cooks who train in the States.
A lot of folks that come from restaurants to here are used to dealing with high-quality produce every single day. So learning, experimenting, figuring out ways to work with dehydrated peppers and dry vegetable broth powder and things like that. How do you make a great meal out of ingredients that might not be the norm?
And there are repercussions when they don't pull it off. Ask anybody in the dining room.
He can make or break the morale of the whole station just by the food they serve.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Absolutely.
Mike Ebel is one of the lead maintenance guys. He's sitting at the table with Dave Ackley from plumbing.
Ask anybody about the food. It's on good food days, the town is happy. On bad food days, we kind of grump around.
Sometimes we all walk away saying, yuck. The cod we got today is pretty good stuff.
Donald Manahan, the scientist, says maybe this isn't the perfect analogy, but mealtime in Antarctica can push people's buttons just like it does in a prison or a nursing home.
There's a feeling of loss of control, and they have to eat whatever shows up that day. And day in, day out, you don't have any control of that. You know, my grandmother, I remember having this conversation with her, and the rest of the family went, oh, she's fine, the food is great, this and the other. And I said, you know, I've just come back from 3 months in Antarctica. And it started to bother me. It starts to get at you. It sounds trivial if you've never been through it, but it's like you're institutionalized.
And occasionally, people lose it. It happened once to Mike Ebel.
I cleared that galley once. I cleared the whole serving area. It was 1994. They curried everything. There was so much curry, curry dessert, curry this, curry that. I just went berserk. They were peeking around the corners at me. Mike, calm down. And all the food and plates got in the way.
By the way, Lynn, despite that embarrassing incident, Mike Ebel has become a valued employee in Antarctica. In fact, government officials just named a small mountain range for him in Antarctica. Ebel Hills, 7,500 feet high.
Oh, that's great. You know, Danny, I know that you and your wife used to write restaurant reviews.
That's right.
So what's your professional critique of the food in Antarctica?
You know, you have to consider that the cooks in Antarctica face crazy challenges, and in view of that, they do very well. On the other hand, Lynn, powdered potatoes can only go so far. So put it this way. When I'd walk into the cafeteria after spending the day on the freezing ice, at that moment, I'd rate the cuisine in Antarctica 4 stars out of 5.
NPR's Danny Zwerdling, thanks so much for being with us. And if you go to npr.org, you'll find a recipe for Danny's favorite dessert in Antarctica, moist Moroccan cake with mint. When Frank Newsom leads his congregation in singing the song Sweet Beulah Land, he's often overcome with emotion. Newsom is the moderator of the Little David Church in Hayside, Virginia. In this week's What's in a Song, our occasional series from the Western Folklife Center, Newsom explains that for him, singing and redemption go hand in hand.
The life that I was living, I didn't like it too good. Out in the world, I turned my life around. Went to talking to the good man above and asking him to help me. I believe I repented of my sins and got right with the good Lord. And the talent that he's given me now, I'm using it for him. I'm kind of homesick for a country to which I before. I'm one out of 22 children. My mommy gave birth to 20 children and had 2 miscarriages. The same father and the same mother, no twins in them. A big family. We didn't have nothing much like other people did, but one thing we had was love, and we looked out for one another.
I'm looking now across the river where my faith well end inside.
I love the sound of that music. I walk with my mother from where we lived in the head of a holler, 4 miles to the church house on Saturday morning and back after meetings over with, and the same thing on Sunday morning. And I just growed up with it, and I love that old sound from a little boy on up.
My loved one now are looking for me.
Every time we meet, we start about 9:30. We've got 91 members. And besides the 91 members on Sunday, we have about 250 that comes to that church and it fills up. And several times, several of them has come forth and tell experience of grace that they've had with the good Lord above. Then we go to the river, to the creek, and baptize them.
I wonder when I'll take my journey. I now say the end inside.
It's just so sweet to me when I can feel the Spirit of the Lord. It makes everything so easy. I guess I go through the motion a lot of preaching and singing. But when the Spirit of the Lord's there, then it's real easy. It's a different tone of my voice when the Lord's blessing me to sing and to preach.
Beulah Land, I'm longing for you, and
What's in a Song is produced by Hal Cannon and Taki Telenidis of the Western Folklife Center.
Our feature, What's in a Song, is produced with support from the George S. and Dolores Dory Eccles Foundation.
This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by David Rector, with production help from Vince Pearson, Laura Kranz, Gemma Waters, David Schulman, Katerina Valdivieso, and Greg Dixon. We had help from our librarians, Key Molesky and Mary Glendenning. Our technical director is Kevin Waite, and our engineers are Kurt Stallnaker and Timothy Olmsted. Our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman. Our senior editor is Jenny Bergall. The show was produced this week by Graham Smith. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. I'm Lynn Neary.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. In nearly every aspect of military capability, from cruise missiles to submarines, satellites to cluster bombs, China has been working hard to modernize its armed forces. That's been some cause for concern in Asia and the United States. Some see it as a natural result of China's emergence as a rising power. Others see danger to the United States and its interests in Asia. Over the past week, we've been featuring stories about China and its changing influence on the world. NPR's Mike Schuster concludes the series today with a report on whether China really poses a threat.
The evidence of China's military modernization is ample. Double-digit increases for military spending since 1989, the rapid expansion of China's cruise and ballistic missile force, and the deployment of hundreds of missiles along China's coast across from Taiwan. The rapid expansion of China's submarine force and the modernization of the missiles those submarines carry, and last year China's destruction of one of its own satellites by a land-based missile, announcing China's unexpected capability in anti-satellite warfare. There is no doubt that China is a rising military power, says former Defense Department official Kurt Campbell, who now heads the Center for a New American Security.
No country has risen to a status of great power as rapidly as China has, I would argue, over the last 20 years.
With its rapidly expanding economy, its growing thirst for energy, and its own perception of itself as an emerging power, it makes perfect sense that China should modernize its military capabilities, says Ralph Kosa, director of the Pacific Forum, a think tank in Honolulu.
They want to have a force commensurate with their political and economic standing in the world, and we shouldn't be surprised by that, and we shouldn't necessarily be frightened by that.
Still, some are frightened by that. They see China's expansion of its military as a direct challenge to the U.S. Just peruse the titles of several new books, The Coming War with China, or Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States, and China Shakes the World, A Titan's Rise and Troubled Future. Susan Shirk is not among the alarmists. Still, in her recently published China, Fragile Superpower, Shirk writes, history teaches us that rising powers are likely to provoke wars.
Let's remember why they provoke war. They provoke war because of the reactions of the present-day powers and not only because of their own behavior. And I have to say that there are reasons to be worried on both scores.
Perhaps no one knows more right now about China's military and especially its naval capabilities than Admiral Timothy Keating. Keating is head of Pacific Command, based in Honolulu. It's his job to watch China's military and watch it closely. He's been to China several times, seen its weapon systems up close, held talks with China's military leaders. He admits China is developing impressive military capabilities, but he says,
the Chinese are behind us. Unmistakably, they know it. In their words, I'm quoting some of them, they're 25 years behind us.
One of the reasons that some analysts in the U.S. are so concerned about China's military development is that it is in part hidden. Chinese leaders have not explained why they shot down their own satellite last year, why a Chinese submarine last year shadowed the U.S. aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk, or why they talk about acquiring aircraft carriers of their own. China needs to be more transparent about its military, and Keating says little by little they are.
Increased transparency can yield to greater trust. That reduces the potential for misunderstanding. Misunderstanding can lead to conflict or crisis.
No area is more fraught with potential conflict for China and the U.S. than Taiwan, which China regards as part of its territory. The recent presidential election in Taiwan, won by a candidate who wants to improve relations with the mainland, may go a long way to cooling potential conflict there. But, says Susan Shirk, China's military modernization has been all about Taiwan and denying the U.S. military access to Taiwan and the area around it in case conflict breaks out.
They want us to really think twice about confronting China's military power in such a contingency.
China does have the capacity to threaten the actual homeland of the United States. It possesses 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles that carry nuclear warheads and could reach the U.S. But these missiles are not on high alert, and the warheads are stored separately from the missiles. Although China is modernizing these missiles, it believes its nuclear arsenal is a minimum deterrent, and in recent years it has not modified that doctrine. Kurt Campbell believes that, with the attention of the U.S. focused primarily on the Middle East, recent administrations have not paid enough attention to what is going on with China's military.
So it's not, I think, any outward and, you know, specific steps that China has taken that are cause for immediate American concern, but it is a pattern of very substantial steps that have led to a rather sharp increase in Chinese power.
China's recent unrestrained crackdown in Tibet adds another element to an understanding of China's military. The People's Liberation Army is used not only against foreign threats, but also against internal challenges, as China's civilian communist leadership sees them. In order to maintain the PLA's loyalty to the civilian leadership, Susan Shirk believes, the military demands and gets its way on military spending. That is not a strength of the Chinese system, in Shirk's view.
I see it more as a reflection of China's internal weakness, and that they need to satisfy the military in order to keep the Communist Party in power.
That's why Shirk calls China a fragile superpower. The current events in Tibet are the most recent evidence of just that. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Leanne Hansen. And joining us is Puzzle Master Will Shortz. Hi, Will. So good to talk with you again.
Hi, Lynn. Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be on the show. And of course, you know, I always get a little nervous around the puzzle because I'm not very good at them.
But, I don't believe it.
But I think they're fun to play anyway. So remind us of the challenge that you left us with last week.
Yes, it sounded a little more complicated than it actually was. I said, think of an adjective starting with over. And what follows over is a word that has a homophone, or a word that sounds the same but is spelled differently. And the puzzle was, think of an adjective starting with over that is frequently used with the homophone of the word that follows over. What is it?
And the answer?
Well, my intended answer was overthrown, and a throne, T-H-R-O-N-E, can be overthrown. We also accepted overseen, and S-C-E-N-E can be overseen. So either one of those was good.
Oh, great. Well, we had over 1,000 entries from people who tried to solve the puzzle, and our randomly selected winner is Emily Gilbert. She's from Appleton, Wisconsin. She joins us now. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
Good to have you.
Thank you.
And what do you do there in Appleton?
I work part-time as a guide at a living history park.
Oh, that sounds like fun, is it?
Mm-hmm.
I bet. Have you been playing the puzzle for a long time?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure exactly, but over 10 years.
10 years. Okay. So you're finally one of the on-air contestants. That's great. Are you ready to play?
As ready as I'll ever be.
All right. Well, I'm sure that you really want to meet Will Short. Will, meet Emily.
All right. Emily and Lynn. Last Wednesday, I was at my alma mater, University of Virginia, where I spoke to about 400 students and played word games. And this is one of the puzzles I brought. Every answer is a familiar two-word phrase with the initials VA. For example, if I gave you the clue, subject of a tax in Britain, you would say value added. All right?
Okay.
Number one is the second in command in the Navy.
Vice Admiral?
That's right. Number two is residue around Mauna Loa, for example.
Volcanic ash.
Good. Law that ushered in prohibition.
Something amendment.
No.
No? All right.
A short word meaning law in three letters.
Act.
Right. And yeah, starting with V. Well, it's possible you don't. Do you know this, Lynn?
I don't know it. I don't know.
It's the Volstead Act.
Wow, I never heard of that.
Okay. Try this one. Painting, sculpture, photography, etc.
Visual arts.
Good. Period in England, known for primness and formality.
Victorian age.
Uh-huh. Kind of belt in astronomy.
Something asteroids?
No.
Huh.
Kind of belt.
Yeah, the blank belt. Yeah, you just might not know it. It's the Van Allen belt.
Huh.
Okay, try this one. 18 in the United States.
Voting age.
Uh-huh. Effort that isn't successful. You do something in a blank to do something, but it's not successful. It's a
vain attempt?
That's it. Good. Huh. Form that's filled out in order to travel to another country.
Visa application?
Yes, that's correct. The last U.S. cabinet department created before Homeland Security. Department of...
Gosh, I don't know.
Before Homeland Security.
Yeah, it's for people who have served in the military.
Oh, okay.
Veterans Affairs is the name of the department. How about military force that does not rely on a draft?
Volunteer Army.
Uh-huh. Contract or understanding that's not written down.
Verbal agreement.
Uh-huh. Epic poem by an ancient Roman writer.
Virgil's Aeneid.
Good. British-owned airline between England and North America.
Something air, certainly, but...
No. It has lots of routes between England and here.
It's not Virgin Air?
Virgin is correct. I guess maybe people say Virgin Air, but the real name of the airline is Virgin Atlantic.
Okay.
And here's your last one, a person's sudden disappearance.
Vanishing act.
Good job.
Yeah, Emily, I think you did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
All right, now, as a special treat, we've brought in NPR's own Danny Swerdling to tell you what you're going to win this week.
For playing our puzzle today, you will get a weekend edition lapel pin. Wow. No, but there's a lot better stuff. The 11th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary and Thesaurus. And you're going to get the Scrabble Deluxe Edition from Parker Brothers. And the Puzzle Master Presents from Random House Volume 2. Emily, there's more. You're going to get Will Schwartz's Little Black Book of Sudoku and the Black and White Book of Crosswords from St. Martin's Press. And you will get one of Will Schwartz's Puzzle Master Decks of Riddles and Challenges from Chronicle Books. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, Emily, tell us, what member station do you listen to?
WPNE in Green Bay.
All right. Well, that's great. And keep listening.
I will.
Emily Gilbert from Appleton, Wisconsin. Thanks again for playing the puzzle with us.
Thank you.
And Will, what's the challenge for next week?
Yes, it comes from listener Jeffrey Harris of Nashville, Tennessee. Think of a six-letter hyphenated word meaning eager. Change the fourth and sixth letters to get another hyphenated word meaning less than eager. What words are these? So again, a six-letter hyphenated word meaning eager. Change the fourth and sixth letters to get another hyphenated word meaning less than eager. What words are these?
All right. You've got your challenge now out there. And when you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. Click on the Submit Your Answer link. And only one entry per person, please. Our deadline this week is Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Please include a phone number where we can reach you at about that time, and we'll call if you're the winner. And you'll get to play Puzzle on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and Weekend Edition's Puzzle Master, Will Schwartz. Thanks a lot, Will. It was good talking with you.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.